Great.
Yeah, so Katie can't make it today, so it's just the two of you, but she's in principle. Great. Yeah, any questions? I'll start now, and I think I have used Roman letters for chapter 2, and just since this formally goes in a combinatorial number, let's call it combinatorial group theory. Or we could have called it finitely presented groups, which is basically the same topic, just looking at it from slightly different aspects. So, if we want to describe groups, there are a couple of ways how we can do so. We can say the group consists of symmetries of a particular object. Okay. That is in some way nice to describe, but it's rather hard to work with this group unless we have a mechanism for working with these symmetries. So we therefore often look at particular symmetries, symmetries of a set, permutations of a set, or symmetries of a vector space in vertical matrices, and we can describe groups by these. Okay, there we have a way to how to work with the elements, how to write things down, but that doesn't necessarily always make it very easy what such a group is. If you go back to the first examples of groups you have probably seen, we could say, and there you might have seen something, you have a group G, which is generated by two elements, A and B, and we have that, I don't know, A square is the identity, B cubed is the identity, and, no, let's write it differently. Let's write it as A, B, A is B inverse, or we could alternatively write this as BA is A inverse, B inverse multiplying with A inverse, and because A square is 1, that A is the same as A inverse, so we could even leave that inverse out. And now the group consists, we know every element is a product of A's and B's, and from this rule we know that if we have an A after a B, we can pull it in front of the B by changing the sign of the exponent of B, and therefore we can conclude this consists of the elements A to the X times B to the Y, where X is 0 or 1, and Y is 0, 1, or 2, and so this group has at most 6 elements. It's not hard to see that it actually has 6 elements. It's a way, the dihedral group of order 6, or the symmetric group on three points. And you've probably seen examples like this. So, that looks nice, but in some way there is a little bit hand-waving where I said, oh yeah, one can easily see there are the elements. Can one always do this? Can one always describe groups in this form? And basically that's what I want to do. Okay. And this form, it's not just convenient. That is a form which comes up automatically if the groups come as symmetry groups of, for example, certain topological spaces. If we look at the fundamental group there, we get automatically a form like this. Okay. Yeah. To actually describe what they are, we need to go a little bit back or to do a little bit more general. And so my first paragraph will be about free groups. And that is something, Ryan, you, I think I did already a bit last year in 567, so there is some duplication. But so, free in algebra basically means that something behaves in a certain sense like a vector space. So, vector spaces and bases have the nice property that if you have a basis, not only does it give you all the information or allow you to write down all the information for a linear transformation, if you write down images of the basis vectors, you know what the linear transformation has to be, but you can also prescribe any linear transformation by writing down arbitrary images of the basis of a basis. And you know there will be a linear transformation. That's the reason why the set of linear transformations is in bijection with the set of matrices. So we have this dual property of basis, well, generating, which means once we know what a homomorphism does on a basis, we know what it does in total, but also the linear independence, which means that if we have a map prescribed on a basis, we know this will extend to a linear transformation. On the other hand, if you pick an arbitrary group and you prescribe a map on generators, that might not be a homomorphism. If you have the symmetric group S3 and you take a map from S3 to S3 where you want to map a three cycle, you pick a generating set 1, 2 and 1, 2, 3 and you want to switch the generators. That cannot extend to a homomorphism because it doesn't behave nicely with element orders. So, in general, that does not work. And if this works, if this property, any map on generators extends to a homomorphism, then this set is called a free generating set. And you can define this for all kinds of objects. Here I will define it for groups. Group G, which is generated by some set S. We don't really need that S is finite, though basically in all the examples I'm going to do, this will be a finite set. But for the theory, this can be something horrendously infinite. That's the same as in linear algebra. You can have infinite dimensional vector spaces, and infinite dimensional vector spaces can have a basis. They have bases. It's just these bases actually aren't particularly useful. Typically, there you want further properties. You want some kind of convergence conditions. So, anyhow, so we have a group here generated by a set S is free on S if for any group, for any H and a map phi from S to H, phi extends to a homomorphism from G to H. So if I prescribe images of a generating set, regardless how I do that, regardless into what group, I get a homomorphism. Then this group is called free on S, and in general, a group is called free. A group is called free if it is free on a generating set, on a on some generating set. And we call the cardinality of S is called the rank of G. So G is free of rank something. Okay. If I define this basically, I should prove that this rank is unique. That's not that hard to prove. And the proof really isn't that interesting. Basically, you go back to the case of vector spaces. You take vector spaces as particular abelian groups and you use the uniqueness of dimension, and it essentially becomes a technicality. So that's something I don't want to go further. Let me just observe, note, if G is free on S, H is free on T, and the cardinality of S is the cardinality of T, then G is isomorphic to H. Why is this the case? Let phi from S to T be a bijection. Then this extends to homomorphism. Because G is free, it and the map is invertible, because I can take the inverse map, I just take the inverse map on the generating sets, and that is again a homomorphism, is invertible. So if we have three groups of the same rank, they are isomorphic, and therefore there is at most one free group of a particular rank. Okay. And we will see there is one, and therefore people often talk about the free group of rank something. And it might just differ on the model how one represents this group. Yeah. Let's also observe if we have that any group is isomorphic to a quotient of a free group. Why that? Well, we can pick a generating set. Well, if the group is not finite, it might be an infinite generating set, but we can always find a generating set, if necessary, the whole group. Set T, then take free group of rank cardinality of this generating set. And then we know we can map the generators of the free group to these generators that extends to a homomorphism. And once we have this homomorphism clearly is onto... Oh yeah, here I didn't say that it's obviously onto, because generators of the image are in the image of the group. It is clearly onto, and then the homomorphism theorem tells us it is isomorphic. Yeah, is, so probably is isomorphic. So any group is quotient of a free group, and basically all of these things here, I've written it for groups, that holds for whatever free thing you do. In vector spaces, every vector space is free if we pick as generating set a basis. And then this is basically saying, yes, the dimension for vector spaces is unique. Two vector spaces of the same dimension are isomorphic. If you have a vector space of a dimension which isn't larger, you can have a homomorphism from a larger dimensional vector space onto it. Okay, so that's so far basically something which one could, in needless generality, write for generic algebraic structures. Of course, the question is, what are actually, do we have free groups? So I need to give you some kind of construction for free groups. What I will do is I will not prove all the things that a group, particular group, is free. And that is essentially just because certain things otherwise become rather lengthy-ish in technical calculations. So, theorem. Let S be a set. There is a free group of rank cardinality of S. And with this observation is there is basically one up to isomorphism. Okay, so how do we construct this group? We need to have some set of I need to describe what the elements are, and I need to describe how to multiply these elements. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I will start with something which I will call an alphabet. These are basically just symbols which I will call letters, and I want this to be in bijection with a set S. So I could just say I pick particular. Let A be an alphabet on S. So I will denote the elements in general here as A1, A2, and so forth. Though I really, if S is uncountable, I would need A, little s, or S in S. Okay. Okay. So I'm taking this alphabet. And what I'm doing is I'm adding extra inverses of these elements. And I'm just doing A, and I will call this A inverse. These are in some way formal inverses. It's just so that would be A1 inverse, A2 inverse, and so forth. And these are formal inverses. Okay. Right. What do I mean by formal inverses? This is just, in some way, it's a different alphabet in bijection to this one. And let's say these are green, then these are gold. I've painted them differently that I can distinguish them, and I will just, in the notation, write them with this inverse symbol here. Okay. And now I consider the set of words in A and A inverse. So let W be the words. Words are just finite sequences with entries chosen from a particular set. It could be the empty sequence. So words, that means finite sequences in A union A inverse. Okay, so for example, it could be A1, A2 inverse, A3 inverse, A2, A1, or so. Right. And I can define a product on W, which is just concatenation. Okay, so I can multiply my generators. What I now need to do is, okay, and concatenation clearly is associative. If I have three things and I concatenate them, I can first concatenate the first two and then append the third, or I can concatenate the second and third and append it to the first. I get the same result. So this gives me obviously an associative multiplication. So what I get in at this point is, and I have obviously an identity, namely that's the empty word. So what I have at this point is something which is called a monoid. A monoid is that is has the axioms for group without the inverse. So we have associative multiplication and we have an identity. There also is a definition of a set of something called a semigroup. A semigroup does not demand the identity. And what I never fully understood is why people study semigroups and not monoids, because if you have a semigroup, you can always add the an identity. If it isn't a monoid, you can add an element which plays the role of an identity element, and you have a monoid. And if you don't have an identity, certain kinds of proofs by induction or so are a little bit contorted because you can't start with a identity element. So anyhow, that's basically just, if you ever encounter the term monoid, that's group without guaranteed inverses. Right, so we have this set. Well, but I don't want a monoid, I want a group. So what I'm going to do next is I'm going to look at a particular equivalence relation. So now consider a relation tilde on W, and what should this relation tilde consist of? Two words, so a word W1, W2 are related. If we can obtain W2 from W1, by a finite sequence of inserting or deleting subwords of the form AI inverse or AI inverse AI. Right? Remember, AI inverse, we call it inverse, but so far it's just a different symbol. It's a copy painted in a different color. Okay. So, if I have in a word, let's say A3 inverse, I could delete this. Or I could go to whatever position in a word, or even to the very start or the very end, and I could insert A2 inverse. And if I can do so with a finite sequence from get from one word to another, I consider them in relation. Okay. And now, I claim this tilde is an equivalence relation. And that is really not hard to show. Every word is in relation to itself. Yes, my finite sequences of substitutions doesn't do anything. Good. If W1 is related to W2, W2 is related to W1. Yes, my sequence of insertion deletions is the reverse, with insert and delete, the roles swapped. Okay, and if W1 is related to W2 and W2 is related to W3, well, then I do the process and one and then the other one, and I get that they are related. So clearly, this is an equivalence relation. That basically is trivial. Okay. So I can look at equivalence classes, and that's what I will call F. Let F be the set of equivalence classes. Right. And I want to define a multiplication on F, which is based, on F, namely, I want that the product of the class with word W1 with the class with word W2 shall be the class with word W1, W2, where the product is just a concatenation. And that's the, I mean, there is nothing deep in that definition or in that idea. Well, what I need to show, or what I would need to show is this is well defined, because I'm defining something on equivalence classes based on representatives. And I would need to show that if I choose a different representative, I get the same result. So. Right, that this is well defined actually isn't particularly hard to do. I just don't want to write it down formally because, I mean, here, this isn't really hard. And what I'm hiding is not bits which are intellectually hard. What I'm hiding are bits which are for writing down really ugly, because you need to talk about sequences in symbols which are indexed with a set and you do something with it. Okay, well, why is this well defined? Let's say I have an equivalent class. Then I have another word, W1 tilde. And I can get from W1 to W1 tilde by a sequence of insertions, deletions. And I have another word, W2 tilde, and I can get there by a sequence of insertions, deletions. Well, the product is just the concatenation. If I take the concatenation and I take the corresponding sequences of insertions, deletions here and there and do them appropriately and accordingly, I get the concatenation of the equivalent words. So clearly that gives me the same result. So this multiplication is well defined. So I have a multiplication on F. Okay. So, what I want, of course, is that F is, for F stands for free, I want this to be my free group. So, what I need to show is that F is a group and that F is free. Okay. So the product on F is associative. And that's the one bit where I'm basically lifting the carpet and brushing all the dirt under it to hide the ugly bits. So So I need to show that multiplication is associative. Why is this something which suddenly, here I said it is trivial. Why is this suddenly so hard? Because I need to deal with deletion. If I have insertions deletion, or I could say with this, I look at canonical representatives where I do all the deletions which are happening. Okay. The problem is, if I'm multiplying three words together, if I have suddenly get deletions which did not happen before. So these are deletions which overlap the border of words. And I could even have deletions if I multiply W1, W2, W3. What could happen is that W2 is completely eaten by cancellation with W1, or is completely eaten by cancellation with W3. And I need to see that I get the same result. That is not hard to prove, but it ends up essentially as a really ugly case distinction, because you need to deal with all of these cases. Okay, you get cancellation here, or you get cancellation here, and what happens if things cancel out and you want to get, and when writing it down, you then need to really say, I get cancellation up to these letters. So you get double or triple indices where something is happening. And in the end, all of the cases essentially end up trivial. There is nothing miraculous happening. It is just an exercise in bookkeeping. And that's why I don't want to do this year. If you're really curious, I don't know whether Rotman does a formal proof. I mean, if you can't find a proof and you really want to see one, I have one which I can give you a copy. But there is nothing interesting.
I still have mine from 567
onward. Yeah. So. Okay.
I think I've seen it before anyway.
So yeah. It's a bit like, I don't know whether you've seen the, if you take some proofs for things which are trivial in the finite case and you do it in the infinite case. Existence of a basis of vector spaces in the infinite dimensional cases. There is nothing surprising in that proof. If you know the proof of existence in the finite case, yes, it works, and it's just you need to carry through some paperwork to do to have things and then work out, and that's the same here. So your product is associative, and I should say, so this is tedious but not hard. Okay. Then I have that the equivalence class of the empty word is an identity element. And if I take the equivalence class, or sorry, let me start differently. If W is a word which consists of the symbols I1 to the epsilon 1, AI2 to the epsilon 2, and so forth, AIK to the epsilon K. And I allow myself with this, so if epsilon is 1, I mean the symbol in A. If epsilon is -1, I mean the symbol in A inverse. Then the class of W has an inverse, namely that's the class of AIK to the minus epsilon K, AIK minus 1 to the minus epsilon k minus 1, and so forth. I do the obvious thing, I revert the order, and I change the sign of the exponents. And once I know that the multiplication is associative, this is clearly an inverse. Because if I write this word and this word one after the other, the symbols on the border will cancel. And then the next symbols will cancel, and everything will cancel out. So that is an inverse. And now, depending on how strict one is with it, basically, you in the definition of a group, you don't need the uniqueness of the inverse. You just need that inverses exist, and then you show inverses have to be unique. And yeah, so that is the not just an inverse, but is the inverse. So F is a set with an associative multiplication and an identity and inverses, and therefore is a group. Okay. Right. And now I claim that this set F is free on, well, the equivalence classes of these generators. Is free on AI in A. Free on these generators. Well, what I need to show is that I can extend any such map, any map on these generators to a homomorphism. So let H be an arbitrary group. And let's say phi is defined on from the generators of F to H. Namely, I want to map the class of the element AI to an element HI in H. Okay, so I prescribe this. Now I want to show phi extends to homomorphism. Well, what the homomorphism would has to do is pretty obvious. So extend phi to the whole of F. Namely, if I have an arbitrary word, AI1 to the epsilon 1 up to AIK to the epsilon k. Where should I map this to? Well, I want to map this to H I1 to the epsilon 1 up to HIK to the epsilon k. That's the only way how it can be a homomorphism. Okay. So, why is this a homomorphism? I just need to show it preserves products. And that's the only property we need for a homomorphism. A map is a homomorphism if phi of A times B is phi of A times phi of B. And all the other things with identity and inverses are consequences of this one if we have the group axioms. Well, so I take a product. I take AI1 to the epsilon 1 up to AIK to the epsilon K. I take a second element, bj1 to the delta 1 up to bjl to the delta l. Okay, and now I once form the product, and I once, and now I just need to be careful in how, so actually, no, I shouldn't call these B, I should call these A, because I have, yeah, I have different indices, sorry, these are the same generators. These are AJ1 up to AJL. And now I once form the product, which is just removing these brackets, and I map, or I map individually and then form the product. And the only thing where something interesting can happen is, if I form the product here first, I could have the elements and their inverses cancel out. But that must also happen in the product, because then I have elements and their inverses in a group, and they will cancel out. And therefore it is a homomorphism. So I have a group with a generating, oh yeah, I didn't say it is generated by A. Let me just state this, generated by these classes. Yeah, obvious, because from these I can form any word.
It's got to be the classes, because otherwise you could have redundant stuff. And
yeah, and I need, formally, I need to have the classes. And basically, after this proof, the classes will go away. So now, what we will do is, identify the class of a word with a cancelled normal form of W. What do I mean by this? By this I mean that I have no AI inverse or AI inverse AI in W. And that's the obvious way how to write down these elements. It's just for the proof, I think I really need to allow this equivalence relation. If I only want to work with normal forms in the proof, things get a bit messy, because I might actually at some point to get to certain equivalences allow insertion of extra symbols to take care of cancellations. So it's a group generated by a set, and we've seen it's free on this set, so we have a free group. There are free groups, and the free groups just consist of such words. Okay. And that is already paragraph one. We should have seen the existence of free groups. Two presentations. Well, we had seen every group is isomorphic to a quotient of a free group. And I want to use this, and I want to use it as a tool for describing arbitrary groups as quotient of a free group. So, definition, let F be a free group on the set A. Here formally this, that would be the equivalence classes bit, and I'm just leaving that away because that it's obvious what is happening. And it's just to write it all down and makes it messy. So we have a free group on A, and let W1 up to W L B words in A together with A inverse. Or I could instead just have said elements of that free group. Okay. Okay, and now I write the following thing down. I write the generator, I write the symbol for a group generated by something, I write the generating set, and I write these words, W1 up to WL. Okay, and what do I mean by this? By this I mean the quotient F modulo N, where N is the smallest normal subgroup of F that contains W1 up to WL. Okay. The smallest normal subgroup containing certain elements, well, so I take all normal subgroups containing the elements and take their intersection. And that is the smallest one. And you could actually describe what it consists of. It consists of these elements and their conjugates by elements in the free group and products of these conjugates. That would be this normal subgroup. So that is just a short form for describing this quotient, and this is what we call is a presentation. So a presentation is generators and words in generators, and we call these words the relators, the WI are called relators. And what one can often do is that people, purely for convenience, write also relations left equals right. Well, how would I get the corresponding relator? This would correspond to the relator left right times right inverse. And that is just sometimes convenient to write down. And essentially, we won't make a big difference between relators and relations. Yes, formally they are different objects. And you can always, when you have groups, you can always sufficient to just work with relators. You could build the same theory for semigroups and monoids. And then things really get far more complicated, because you don't have the inverses. So you really need to work with relations. And things get more messy. But here we can just form these, yes. And formally, this set, I say this is a presentation, or we could say this F modulo N is a finitely presented group. So if A is finite, F modulo N is a finitely presented. Okay, finitely, just I want finitely many symbols, I want finitely many relators, and otherwise in the definition there is nothing to stop me doing this in an infinite case. Just gets ugly. So that is a finite And I will basically not distinguish presentations and finitely presented groups. Formally, some people talk about presentations as syntactic structures, strings, because they want to manipulate these things and then say this is a different thing, while it's the same group. But basically, that's not something we need to worry about, right? We are out of time. Thank you very much.